back to Women Making Moves, where we celebrate the moves that women are making. My name is Amy Pons, founder of Unlock the Magic, coaching, marketing, and energy healing. I'm joined today with Rowena Chu. Rowena is a former assistant to Harvey Weinstein. In 1998, she was sexually assaulted by him at the Venice Film Festival and was coerced into signing a non-disclosure agreement, which silenced her for over 20 years. In 2017, a New York Times journalist came to her home and doorstepped her husband of over a decade, revealing information about the assault and NDA. Rowena was featured in the subsequent New York Times investigation, but she insisted on remaining anonymous. In 2019, she finally broke her story on the NBC Today Show, live, in front of 3 million viewers. Rowena's story is featured in both the book and the movie She Said. She has given over 700 media interviews across 4 continents for international news outlets such as ABC, BBC, CBS, and NBC. She has testified at the House of Commons, the Massachusetts State House, and the State of the Union. She's writing a memoir, a novel, and a screenplay, in addition to working as a global Me Too activist, advocating for the rights of those who are oppressed or voiceless in churches, schools, universities, and workplaces around the world. Rowena, welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
I have so much rising in me that I want to ask you, talk to you about. One, how's your heart?
My heart today is, I got to say, a little bit fractured. You know, I think we're all sort of reeling from the national election. And it's not really only the result, but the things that were said and done in the lead up to that election that really give you an indication of where we are as a nation and where we are as a society. And I would say that I am troubled. I think I'd be hard pressed to think that there isn't a woman in the nation that is, you know, troubled in some way about what has taken place over these weeks.
Oh my gosh, where to start? Rowena, I feel absolutely kindred with you. And I think the hardest part for me is understanding my privilege as a white woman and how hard I worked to educate and inform.
Yeah.
Over the past few months, we had 100 days. The moment that VP Harris was announced and announced her campaign, I started to get really loud because I knew that one of the main statistics from 2016 was that the majority of white women did put Trump into the White House. So I felt a social responsibility as a white woman to stand on my privilege and to share and educate. And it was never about tearing him down. It was about lifting her up. That was my whole stance. And energetically, I felt days before heading into the election, I was like, oh my God, it's going to be him.
Yeah.
I just had this overwhelming sense.
Yeah.
And I was starting to prepare myself, but I still don't know that I don't know that you could have been prepared. And to your point, the women that feel excited about this turn of events, I find it challenging to be in space with them right now.
Yeah.
That's just where I am.
Yeah.
And I will continue to meet myself and others where they are, but I go back to what you said. You couldn't imagine any woman being in good shape right now. There are.
And I can't believe that deep down, there isn't a seed of concern or doubt about the future of women in this country, even from those who live in definitively red states and even those who have been solidly on Trump's side of things. I think his track record as a serial sexual assaulter, not to mention the many other troubling things about his personality and track record and character, even if you focus purely on the aspects of his character that relate to Me Too, are deeply concerning, surely, for women of any political affiliation.
Rowena, I want to just honor and thank you. So aside from who America just chose as its leader, I don't know one woman that has not been assaulted, taken advantage of in a sexual, physical, verbal, psychological, in the workplace, in personal life. I don't know one woman that hasn't.
Right, right. And that is literally why the movement carries this name, Me Too. You know, of course, that term has been in public parlance now for so long that we tend to overlook it. But if we unpick what Me Too truly means, it was literally that. It was literally in 2017 when all of this was reignited that women really came out and they told stories about when they were 5 years old and they told stories about when they were in church and they told stories about when they went to the shopping mall or when they were babysitting their nephews or when they were simply walking across a parking lot late at night. And so I think that the, you know, the overwhelming response from ordinary women and some men to that hashtag is really indicative of where we are as a society and the deep importance of normalizing discussion and debate around sexual assault.
I love that word, normalizing. Not normalizing the assault, the right that you have to talk about it and that it's not your fault. I think in your experience, would you agree that, well, for me personally, before I started talking about my own experience with not only workplace abuse, but personal abuse, childhood abuse, things like that, I used to feel very shameful. I didn't feel like I could say it out loud because then I'm like damaged. That's what I felt like.
And I think a lot of that is the way in which society frames sexual assault. And frankly, more broadly than that, really, the way that society frames our identity as women and our role in society, our role, our place in the home, our place in workplaces, how we operate in society and what society tells us about what should be considered normal, what should be considered our position in society. And I think all of these things require reform. And I think the Me Too movement has brought these conversations to the surface, but there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of women truly achieving equity, not only on a political platform, but also on a societal and cultural basis.
Right, right. Being outspoken like we are, and I've only been outspoken for, I would say, 2 years. Before that, I was under the kind of corporate handcuffs, if you will. I had to hold it all in and put on my mask, my persona of a corporate executive. So now that I'm saying all the things out loud, I get a lot of feedback or DMs about like, oh, can you not call it gaslighting? Can you not call it assault? Like, is it that deep? Are you overreacting? That's exhausting.
It is exhausting. And on behalf of society, I apologize that that is happening to you. But the idea that society is constantly telling women to minimize their voices, to reduce their language, to be less threatening, to not make men uncomfortable, to not speak about their daily experiences as those daily experiences are minimized and diminished and somehow reduced in what they are. And until we as a society can come to a place where we see women and we acknowledge their experiences, we are really doing society as a whole a disservice, not just doing half of society a disservice, but this is something that affects all of us, regardless of where we are on the gender spectrum, regardless of the color of our skin, regardless of our economic status. If we as a society cannot fully acknowledge the female experience, then I feel that there is something deeply lacking and we're really failing as a society.
If we would have talked a month ago, we would have had such great, we're like, oh, we're not going back. We're heading forward. Oh gosh, today, again, let me not cry and bring the vibe down. So I love what you said about until we stop trying to tone down the language. I'll give you a personal example. I've had to release people in my life that were my soulmates, friendships that I thought I was going to have to the grave because one of their husbands touched my breast and I called it assault and they cast me aside because I was using that quote unquote harsh language. Well, to me, I did feel assaulted. I felt violated.
Yeah.
They too were asking me to be quiet. That's not who he is. I'm like, well, more than one thing can be true at once.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So where at this point, I go back to your timeline as it relates to the sexual assault you experienced from Harvey Weinstein, 1998, and then coming forth or having it, am I to understand that it came to light without your, like in 2017, when you said your husband was doorstepped, it came forth without your consent?
Yes, I suppose that's one way of characterizing it. So that particular incident, Jodie Cantor came to my house here in Silicon Valley. And at the time I was in the UK. And I, you know, I do choose to believe it was a genuine mistake on Jodie Cantor's part in terms of we have talked about it greatly since that incident, of course. And the story that she tells me is that she genuinely was not aware that my husband didn't know. You know, I think that that is credible. But nonetheless, I think it is difficult and shocking. And it certainly was a rupture in my life in terms of something that I had been forced into keeping silent and buried and secret for so long. for various reasons, really coming to the fore without my knowledge or consent or compliance or involvement is still a very difficult thing to live with. I mean, I'm really lucky because my husband was incredibly supportive and he immediately saw the social justice angle. And he's really encouraged me, along with other women, to speak out and to be part of this social justice movement. And he very much saw it as that. And he didn't take it personally in terms of my keeping secrets from him or anything like that. But I think that my feelings about that NDA and the idea of having to keep something so huge secret for so many years and actually decades are really complicated. Nothing like that is ever quite straightforward. Of course, there's a dark side of that in the sense that Weinstein used an entire network of powerful men, mainly men, lawyers, other board members, people with money to kind of keep Zelda Perkins and I as two young assistants aged 25 and 24 at the time, completely silent. And that is obviously a horrific form of abuse in its own right. At the same time, it is now public knowledge that the Schedule 5 on our NDA was a list of our friends and family at the time that knew about my employment with Weinstein and the subsequent assault. And so one of my reasons for not telling future people that entered my life years later is in part obviously on the dark side due to the NDA constricting us from doing so. But on the more positive side, I didn't want to bring anyone into that circle of suspicion that would mean that they would be tracked by Harvey Weinstein. I wanted to start afresh, create a part of my life that didn't belong to Harvey, to be with somebody whose name was not listed on a Schedule 5 in a non-disclosure agreement with Harvey Weinstein in 1998. And so it was a form of protecting my own personal life to have my husband and my kids entirely separate of Weinstein, and to have given away the money that came with the settlement agreement. Because I remember even at the age of 24 thinking a sensible thing to do with money that you get with the settlement agreement is to somehow invest it in property. But if you invested in property, then any house that you live in the future will be in part paid by Harvey Weinstein. And I didn't want a penny of that money to feel that I didn't make it myself in my life in the future. And so I had an agreement with Zelda Perkins that we would give away that money. And so the idea 20 years later that I would be, you know, the detractors will always say she made up the whole story so that she could go after Harvey for money. And the money that she was given in 98 wasn't sufficient. So she came back in 2017 for more money. Where the reality is that we gave away the money and we didn't allow a penny of that or a cent of that to really darken our lives and pollute our lives today. Let me just say that there's a lot of misinformation in the world. And I think that this election shows more than anything the misinformation that's often directed at women, and that it's okay now to tell a blatant lie that has no ground in fact. And if you say it often enough, it becomes a truth simply because you say it out loud and you repeat it over and over again. And so just like with this election in the Me Too movement, there were so many myths floating out about women, that women make these things up for attention, that they make these things up for money or to get close to somebody who's famous. When in reality, the statistics don't bear that truth out. The idea that women would create a false narrative around sexual assault when they themselves are often the ones punished for speaking out, they're ostracized for speaking out, they are frequently silenced. If you speak out, if you whistleblow in a corporate environment, in a workplace, it is frequently you that loses your job or gets pushed out of a workplace or perhaps even gets pushed out of an industry. So given that long list of personal, financial and professional cost, what woman in their right mind would truly come forward with a false accusation?
And you know what? I got news for everybody. I'd rather take the risk listening to a story from a survivor on any front and believing them unabashedly than to not and go to an assumption where like, we'll prove it. No.
Yes.
Listen, exactly. You can unabashedly believe and listen and open yourself to hearing someone's lived experience.
That's right. And then for the very, very few cases where you might be wrong, in that case, your only crime has been to have too big a heart, too wide and too generous a heart. And I think far better to err in that direction than to crush the vast numbers of women who are afraid to speak up because they see that society doesn't believe women.
Again, Rowena, I had this happen just recently with a friend of a friend where this man was actually touching us in ways we didn't feel comfortable. We didn't feel comfortable with the way that he was touching the small of our back or lingering on the side of our stomachs. And so I took it upon myself to share with him, hey, can you please not touch us? The way this man lost his mind at me for saying that, how dare you say that I'm a this, that, or the other? It wasn't well received. And so I spoke outward once again on LinkedIn. I said, the reason, how many millionth reason that women don't say something.
Yeah.
This is why. It just happened to me again.
But I find it staggering that we live in a world literally where you see memes and t-shirts now of your body, my choice. And this, I think, what happened to you over the summer is in some small part of your body, my choice. I mean, really what he's saying to you is you don't have a right to determine what is comfortable for your body. He has the right to judge what is comfortable in your body. I find that completely staggering that we live in that kind of world. And whether or not he realizes that to be true, he is part of that problem. And he's on that dynamic of your body, his choice. Absolutely staggering. And I think when I talk about, when we use the word normalization earlier, when we talk about that word, what I think is deeply important about the Me Too movement, and I said this right from the beginning, is we cannot have the Me Too movement rooted in a so-called a few bad apples. The idea that Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer and Jeffrey Epstein, once they're in jail, we're going to be fine. We're going to be done. We put away these few bad apples and generally society is full of good men and women. What the Me Too movement really needs to be about is Joe from accounting. And I know that you have experienced a toxic workplace situation, as indeed have I. And I think what most people experience in their toxic workplace cultures is not the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, but the Joe from accounting. The one that leans a little bit close when you bring your PowerPoint presentation into the boardroom. The one that makes inappropriate remarks about the receptionist in the front lobby. The one that says, oh, I was just joking. It's just locker room speak. I don't know why you women take it so seriously. All the rest of that stuff. The one, even outside of the field of sexual assault, just speaks over women in board meetings or takes credit for their work. This is all part of a dynamic of toxic misogyny that we've allowed to prosper in this society, in this country for far too long.
Imagine if in the workplace, the moment that someone does talk over you, that woman, that person feels, I feel violated right now. I feel assaulted right now.
Yeah.
And letting that, allowing that sink in to be true. And you know, everybody around would be like, whoa, to your point, they'd say, whoa, you're overreacting. That's not assault. Right. Wait, who says it's not?
Yeah.
I get to feel violated in this moment when you talked over my voice.
Yeah. And as they say, 1,000 raindrops creates a storm. And I think that that is really the impetus of the Me Too movement is 1,000 voices speaking up at once just to be believed against the word of one man, which is both shocking and miraculous. Shocking that so many women had to speak out about Harvey Weinstein himself to be believed, but also the power of having all those voices together. And so now I think the real work in terms of what is happening in everyday homes, workplaces, political parties, places of religion, places of worship, is that women are having to come together and to do the work to normalize this sort of situation one by one and to have that reaction happen time and again so that we can kind of break down the taboo around speaking out about sexual assault and speaking about women's bodies and really just speaking about what it takes to create a safe space for women in this environment, in this society, in this country.
Yes. And you started that ripple, Rowena. So thank you. Can you take us kind of into the space of like day one, Me Too, of what that looked like?
Yeah. So for me, the story started with that driveway scene. I was in the UK at the time with my children when a New York Times reporter, who I later discovered to be Jodi Kantor, came to my doorstep and spoke to my husband. And of course, my husband immediately called me once she left and said, hey, a New York Times reporter was here today. And I want to say that I didn't know what she came for. But of course, I did know what she came for. My heart just sank at that thought because I felt over 20 years that I'd never truly been free of the Harvey story. You know, journalists had come and gone. And although I lived in a belief now that I'd moved on and I was in a different industry, and I was married with children living in an entirely different continent from when this happened to me, I felt that the story would catch up with me one day. You know, I think women have a sixth sense when they're being tracked, when they're being followed. And so many of Harvey's survivors had felt that shadow over them since signing a non-disclosure agreement with Harvey Weinstein. And he would put forward the idea that he would follow us for the rest of our lives and he would know where we were and who we talked to and who we married and what jobs we did. And I think that was true, that I always had a sense of feeling haunted by this story, that one day it would catch up with me. You know, I spoke very shortly afterwards after the reporter came, I spoke with Zelda Perkins in a sort of hushed conspiracy theory sort of way, whispered conferences in the bathroom. My children were very young and I didn't know to what extent I would go public, and I didn't want to have them talk about it at school or talk out of turn. So we lived in a small apartment at the time with four children. And so a lot of this took place in kind of these hunched over the phone, hiding in the bathroom, which sort of added to that sense of secrecy and paranoia about it all. Zelda Perkins and I, although we co-signed the same non-disclosure agreement, part of that agreement had not spoken to one another since the day of signing. So from October the 23rd, 1998, until the fall of 2017, when the story broke, we had maintained an absolute silence. Neither of us had reached out to the other in all that time. My initial agreement was that Zelda could go public. She was willing to do so. She was more outspoken than me. I will say that I think that not being a person of color helps in terms of the courage and the platform to speak out. So I think it was much harder for me, cultural reasons. I had young children. There were many factors that kind of kept me silent for longer. But I was proud of Zelda and I wanted to be supportive of her willingness immediately to jump into the fray and to speak out. And so the agreement I came to with Zelda is that she would go forward with our joint story, that her name would be the one in the papers, and that I would simply be the anonymous second assistant that was assaulted in Venice. And to be honest, for a long time, I didn't think I would change that. I felt that as a person of color and as someone of Asian heritage, I did feel all of this shame, the shame paradigm that keeps so many women imprisoned. I was worried that I would bring dishonor to my family and to my community and to the Chinese race as a whole if I spoke out about it. So I feel that ethnic and racial factors really played a big role in my remaining silent for so long. And the other factor, of course, is that I was raising a young family and I had four really young children. My oldest was only 8 at the time. So I had two girls who were 8 and 5. That's still very young. And they had two little boys who were 3 and almost a newborn baby of 4 months old. And so these kids were tiny and my life was consumed with taking care of them. And so the idea that I would go onto a public platform and speak to reporters and turn up on TV was really something so outside the realm of my imagination. I just couldn't credit being able to do that. And so lots of people ask me, okay, then if that was true in 2017, you know, what changed? I would say that throughout the rest of 2017 and all of 2018, I was pretty resolved to be silent. Of course, I live in Palo Alto. And so over the summer of 2018, I was really able to observe my fellow Palo Altan, Christine Blasey Ford, you know, with great courage, give her testimony to the assembled Congress people and, you know, to really speak out about Brett Kavanaugh. And of course, I also saw the results of that, which were namely that, well, he became a Supreme Court judge anyway, and he still got confirmed. So, you know, that really spoke a lot to me about where we're at as a society and to what extent we value or don't value the word of women. At the beginning of 2019, again, I was still very mired in my conviction not to speak out. Jodi Kantor had only kept in touch with me through my lawyer, who for a long, long time was Nancy Erica Smith. You may recognize her name from the Gretchen Carlson case against Roger Ailes and Fox News. So she was a prominent civil rights lawyer, a prominent employment lawyer, who was no stranger to defending a high-profile woman against a high-profile man. And so Jodi Kantor kept in touch with Nancy Erica Smith, and that is how we communicated for the longest time, for 18 months. In the end, the deadlock was broken because Jodi invited me to a gathering at Gwyneth Paltrow's house at her home in Hollywood. That was a small and intimate gathering. It's featured in the last chapter of the book, She Said. And present at that meeting were Jodi and Meghan themselves, of course, Christine Blasey Ford and her two lawyers, Lisa Banks and Deborah Katz, a Trump accuser, Rachel Crooks, and Ashley Judd and Gwyneth Paltrow, and Laura Madden and Zelda Perkins from the Weinstein story. So I did feel that this was a private enough gathering for me to feel it wouldn't get leaked to the press, other than the press that were in the room, of course. And so I felt safe enough to kind of go, or at least have my interest piqued. And the deal was that I could go and I still didn't have to reveal my name or tell anything of my story. So I give them credit that they gave me a lot of grace and space to keep my story private. So I went to that gathering and I did share something of my personal story. And that was the first time that I'd shared my personal story outside my immediate circle of friends and family. In April, Zelda asked me to testify at the UK House of Commons to their select committee on sexual assault in the workplace. And I had to think about that greatly because this would be something different. This would be something public. It would be a testimony that would be officially recorded and entered into the annals of the House of Commons. So for those of us that are British, this is similar to going in front of Congress and offering a testimony. And the mere thought to be fair, made me want to vomit. But I did that testimony in April. It was completely terrifying. I did it in under the auspices of Witness B. I did not give my name even at the door to enter the House of Commons. I was Witness B all the way along at my testimony. My nameplate in front of me read Witness B. This is how paranoid I was about my name getting out into public. I think that both the gathering at Gwyneth's house, the ability to talk to Dr. Ford as an individual and to talk through what happened to her in 2018, and then the subsequent testimony in the House of Commons, all came together to give me the courage and the conviction to come forward. I did that testimony at the House of Commons in April of 2019. By May of 2019, I called Jodi Kantor and said I was willing to have my name published in her book. I think she nearly fell off her chair after 2 years of discussing this. They had said that the book had already gone to print, but they would be willing to do a series of extensive interviews with me to pull the book back from the printers and to rewrite a section so that my name could be included in the publication of that book. And so it was that over the summer, that was a very weird waiting time where I already had done the interviews. I knew I was going to be in the book. I knew the production of the book was undergoing through that summer and that the release date would be sometime in the fall. And so sometime over the course of that summer, Jodi called me when I was in the UK to say that the book would be published on September the 9th and inviting me to sit with them on the couch at the NBC Today show and break my story and to reveal my name to the public for the first time. And so that is really the journey of how I went public. And of course, in that journey, when I agreed to do that original breakfast appearance on the NBC Today show, I would have no idea of what was to follow. In fact, I was really naive about that. And I thought everybody will have their 15 minutes of fame. I'm not a famous person. I'm like the 60th person to speak out about Harvey Weinstein. And so the world would say, oh, that's very interesting. A new voice has spoken out about Harvey for 15 minutes. And I would get maybe a little bit of press for a day or two. And then I would disappear into oblivion again. And of course, that none of that happened.
Were you already in or creating the Me Too movement at that point?
No, I mean, the Me Too movement is a very nebulous thing, right? What does the Me Too movement really mean? Around the time of October the 7th, many of my friends from the Jewish community here in Palo Alto spoke about their pain that the Me Too movement, they felt, had not been a Me Too movement for Jews, that the Me Too movement had not spoken out more about the atrocities of October the 7th. And of course, while I am absolutely deeply sympathetic to that, and I do see that that silence there being incredibly painful, at the same time, in the gentlest possible way, I was also saying, I think that's really interesting because the Me Too movement, unlike Time's Up, never had a CEO or a budget or an office. So around the time of October the 7th, about this time last year, when we talked about how the UN Council for Women didn't speak out enough, and neither did the Me Too movement, I said, well, you can't actually put those two things in the same sentence because the Me Too movement isn't an organization in the sense that even the different branches of the UN are. There is no central person who's responsible for what the Me Too movement does or does not do. It's very much a grassroots movement in the sense of the movement being really, it started as a hashtag, right? Were women right. willing to place it as a hashtag on their social media? And it really hasn't much formalized beyond that. So I do a lot of work where I label myself as a Me Too activist and an advocate, but I'm not paid by the movement. I'm not an employee of a movement. I merely call attention to the hashtag as any other individual or any other woman can. I don't think there is such a thing as being part of the movement or not being part of the movement. Any woman that posts Me Too on their social media is already part of the movement because it is such a grassroots movement. And as such, it belongs to all of us.
That's so exquisite and powerful. So would you say that one of the asks is for women to continue carrying the torch of Me Too?
I think that would be a tremendous thing. I actually did an interview for UAE Radio yesterday only, which is interesting. And I mentioned that it was for UAE only because I am continually fascinated that in 2024, 7 years on from these times that we speak of, 2017, that the reach of the Me Too movement, given that it's not formalized, there's no organization, there's no budget even, can extend all around the world. And I can still be speaking about Me Too issues, you know, to a similar size audience to NBC Today Show, actually 3 or 4 million viewers out in Dubai. I think that's actually kind of fascinating. But what I was going to say about that is one of the questions in the interview, which gave me pause, was very interesting. I often get asked, how successful do I think the Me Too movement has been? And do I now feel that it's a failure? Because in the initial days, it was very much in the press and prominent, and then it sort of disappeared under the surface, and people feel that it's no longer in existence, or it's no longer doing anything effective. And I said, well, I would really push back against that. I would say, yes, I agree that in the early days, it was very much in the headlines, as anything is, you know, in the early days, it was a public feeding frenzy in the media. But I feel deeply content that it's moved on to a stage where the real work is being done in terms of changes to law and policy. You will notice that when my bio was shared earlier, that there's evidence of my working with a number of nonprofits and testifying in state houses and at the State of the Union and various courthouses around the country and indeed around the world. And I think that is the hard work that is invisible and unrecognized by wider society. But if we are not advocating for true changes in law and policy, then you're not changing the fate of someone who is being abused at work and who needs a legal or policy or HR policy leg to stand on in order to bring a complaint forward.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the homework.
That's the homework assignment.
That's the homework assignment. Ooh, so many are being watched. Meaning, you know, so I have a lot of behind the scenes DMs or messages from women who are saying this is happening as well. But yeah. X, Y, or Z is watching me, so I can't interact with your content, things like that. And I will say that now I feel we're going to head underground for a little while with the energy of the sun. So don't sleep on this. You know, we're not going away anytime soon. Yeah, yes. We're not going anywhere. So amazing. So as we start to wind down, you're a newly elected official. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It was a huge surprise to me. It was a very brutal race, I would say. I think that this is a really difficult time for women to run for public office, for women of color in particular to run for public office. I was very gratified that a student journalist actually, and of course it had to be a student journalist, because in some ways the children are braver than we are. A student journalist came and interviewed me about the idea of women of color running for office, from Kamala down to myself on a local basis. And she interviewed me to talk about misogyny and racism in various races in this country, on every level, in fact. And I do think that, you know, what happens in the race for the White House trickles down to these local elections. And I will say that I found the racism and misogyny that was ever present in this campaign to be horrifying. And I would say still shocking, even though you sort of know that this is all out there when you're confronted with it and you've put yourself out there and you're working, you know, on a voluntary basis to serve the community. I think it is shocking when you get this kind of blowback. Shocking, but unsurprising at the same time. Every woman in the world will know what I mean by shocking and unsurprising at the same time.
I mean, that's how I've been feeling for a week now.
Right.
And reconciling all of that together. That's why it's like, just meet yourself where you are the best you can, because more than one thing can show up at once. Like, I'm not surprised and I'm shocked. Like, holy shit, I don't know what to do with all of that, but we're doing the best we can. So congratulations.
Thank you.
What are you most excited about coming up? Because I was seeing several posts that you were making recently on Instagram. There's a lot of work within the Me Too movement that you're excited about. So I'd love to hear about what you're excited about, both within Me Too, but also as a newly elected official.
Thanks for asking that. I will say that I thought that running a political campaign was so consuming. I think I was a bit naive about what it takes to run for school board. And I thought it was a bit like being a PTA president of an actual school, which I've done a lot of. And so I had no idea that I would basically be running a professional campaign, be running a campaign team, and that we would have a substantial budget, and that we would be doing professional media advertising and all the rest of that stuff. So I think that that has consumed me a great deal in the past 3 months. And of course, the work of the Me Too movement never ends. And so I did, with great reluctance, kind of have to set that aside for a while. And I think you saw my Instagram post, that I have a bit of a tsunami of Me Too events coming to hit me, because I set them aside. And now I'm like, oh, I've got to pull them all out of the woodwork. So yes, it's true. I'm speaking at quite a few universities in the coming weeks. I'm speaking at Princeton, Santa Cruz, Oxford, London, and Manchester. So I'm going back to the UK to do a bit of a tour there. And I do think, you know, every time I come out and share my story, but also speak about where the movement is now and inspiring women, especially young women, to come out and do something about what is happening to them, what is happening to fellow women around them. It is, of course, a very inspiring thing for me as well. And I think that it works in a way to take the temperature of the room and to understand where society is at. And one thing that is true that in the last 5 years of speaking out publicly about Me Too, I see the needle move, perhaps sometimes imperceptibly or sometimes by a large amount, by what the temperature of the room is like, what people are saying. Are there journalists in the room? What are they reporting about in terms of Me Too? So I think that taking this work into university spaces is particularly important because we're empowering the next generation to change the narrative, to go out and to speak about things that they see in front of them or things that happen to them specifically. And the idea of reclaiming our voice and reclaiming our narrative and knowing that we have the power to change things happening in society is a deeply important message that those of us who are doing this kind of work in this generation can impart to the next generation, who are already far smarter, far wiser, but also much more perceptive and insightful about these things than we ever could be. And so you hear a lot about the hope that's pinned to the next generation. I turned 50 this year and I have a 15-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old daughter. And I do pin a lot of hope on the next generation and their awareness of things that are rotten in our society and their willingness to make change.
I feel the same way as an elder millennial. It took me a long time within my life to feel not only okay, but safe and empowered and tap back into my magic, my power, my value, and my voice matters. I matter. It took me a little bit longer. And now I'm out here on the forefront, making sure that every woman before me, after me, with me, has the same capacity on their timeline, allowing that space. So, Rowena, there was something really disturbing that happened the day after the election in Canada, in which a group of young men were shouting at a young woman, "Your body, my choice." If we see that out here in public, what would you give as an advice? Like, I personally, I would want to usher that woman to safety. Like, I'd want to put my physical body in between that.
Right.
What would you share? What would you do?
Yeah. I mean, I do think it's important for women to protect one another. So you're right. I think the first thing to acknowledge is it's important not to walk away. You know, we're constantly telling the children, be upstanders, not just bystanders. It's not good enough just to watch and not participate in that kind of abuse. It's important to actually stick your neck out and get in there. But you're right. Physically, we don't have, you know, we often are in situations of threat where if it came down to a fight, we wouldn't win that fight. And so I agree that discretion is a better part of valor. And I would say, do put your body between her and the people that are aggressing her. But if it's a whole group of men and one woman, then I think ushering that woman out is not a sign that we're backing down or backing away or giving in to or acquiescing to that policy. But it's like being wiser serpents, being able to say, we're taking ourselves out of that situation. And we don't have to engage with every form of stupidity. Can I just say that as a blanket statement? I think there's been a lot of, you know, the Me Too movement obviously has got us fired up. And we're like, we must fight. We must ride at dawn. And I obviously, I am part of that movement. And so I encourage the riding at dawn. But we also have to be, I think we have to exercise discretion about that. There are fights we are going to win. And they're just fights we are not going to win. And we need to save our energy for the fights that truly, truly matter.
Yeah, Rowena, I agree with you. I don't want one more woman to put herself in danger. And for me, I will have mace or pepper spray with me at all times. So if that group of men comes toward me, they're going to get a fun surprise.
Yeah, you got it. Yes.
So,
and you can use that in defense of the sisterhood. And
exactly.
We live in a world now of social media. Defense. So I would film things because, you know, people need to know that their actions are on record.
So you're right. First thing, I'll take out my phone, start recording.
You got a mace in the right hand and your phone in the left hand. And then you wave.
Will you say that again? Will you say that again?
You've got your mace in the right hand. You've got your phone in the left hand and then you weigh in.
Yes. Let's fucking do this. Oh, I'm getting excited. Okay. So Rowena, where can we find your work? How can we keep up with what Rowena is doing, feeling both in Me Too and as elected official in the school board?
Yes, you're so kind. I am very available on social media. I am on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, Threads, the whole work, and X, of course, although you know, I think we're all moving away from that platform.
Yep.
But, you know, I'm always delighted to hear from people because I do fundamentally believe that Me Too is a grassroots movement. And I've had the privilege of many women sharing their stories with me over social media. Indeed, that's how I connected with you, Amy. And that's how I connect with many people who are podcasters and journalists and then just also everyday survivors. And so in my capacity as an elected official and as a Me Too activist, I want to remain very available to other women that want to come forward and share their stories with me. me. So for anyone listening to this podcast, I absolutely encourage you to reach out to me. I'm easily found on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, all of these social media platforms that I mentioned, and I would be delighted to hear from you.
Rowena, closing remarks as we wrap up.
What can I say? It is a dark time. I think grieve as you need to grieve. Go and hide under the comforter. Go and make hot chocolate for yourself. Go and watch your favorite soap opera, read your favorite romance novel, whatever it is, that what is the thing that you need to grieve. And then once that appropriate time of grief is past, get out and fight. There's a lot of work to be done. The fight is not done. It can only be another 4 years. We can take this back. We can change things. I heard someone say this morning that we as a society are always going to be moving forward. Those that want us to regress can only tie our feet so that we move forward more slowly, but we are still moving forward. And I think that's a beautiful analogy and one of hope, that no matter how fast or slow we move, we are still moving forward.
Thank you, Rowena.
Of course, it was a great delight to speak with you. A great honor to be on your podcast.